Let us look at the next risk, which is more of a security risk, right? Now, why security risk? Because this is becoming increasingly important nowadays, right? Your confidential information needs to be protected, right? As part of operations, it cannot be leaked out. Data security is required, right? So here, what aspects can help cover this risk? If there are security guidelines in place, right? The organization or service provider has say proper security policies or compliance in the organization. So if the service provider is following a security structure, he will have, and he can show you those security policies and guideline documents which are used in the organization. Security, as I said, is becoming critical day by day, and hence it is important or required to be covered contractually under the contract. Security breaches need to be covered, because as I mentioned, these are increasing day by day. The threat to security is large, so handling this risk becomes important under the contract as well. We have a couple of more risks, so let us look at the next one, which is technology risk. So what is a technology risk? Technology risk basically leads to assessing what technology is in use for delivering the product, right? So for example, you have Windows, which started right from currently you are at Windows 10, and Windows 11 is also on release from the end user side. But on the hardware or server side, yeah, where you have the server installations, you have setups which are still running Windows 2000 server or Windows 2003 server, which are now end of life and end of support, right? So these systems are still in use, but they are not supported officially by Microsoft, right? So essentially it's a technology risk, because what will happen is, if this particular server breaks down and there is an issue with that operating system, Microsoft would not be supporting it, right? So what you are essentially doing is, you have the risk of running this setup on a technology which is already end of support, right? So that's a technology risk. What happens in such cases, the non-supported OS, the example which we are using, it is more prone to hacking also, right? Because the newer ones, say Windows 2019 server, that has been built to take care of these risks, right? They have been tested under the current environment and they are more sturdy. But the earlier ones, where the understanding was low or less and which has gone out of support, they are more prone to hacking, right? So this is an example of technology risk. And then the legacy setup, right? These are also categorized under technology risk, because these setups, as I mentioned, because they are legacy, nobody has looked at upgrading them to the latest technology, probably trying to build them up, right? So these are some of the risks under technology. Let us look at probably last under risk mentioned, business continuity risk, right? So there can be a risk to business continuity as well in outsourcing. You have outsourced your entire operations to the service provider, and service provider is hit by, say, a large power outage, or there is a force majeure, a natural calamity, flood, earthquake, fire, right? Political instability in terms of riots where the service provider offices. So these I would say impact the service provider business, and because the service provider is offering his services to you, your business has gone at risk, right? service provider is, say, unable to deliver for a period of, say, a week in continuity. For you or the customer, you are now stuck with that gap in production for that entire week, and your business has gone to a risk zone. So business continuity, so it becomes important here for mitigating such kind of risk. Your BCPDR, your business continuity plans and disaster recovery plans, become essential, right? They become essential for both. The customer org should have these so that they work out something which keeps their business running in absence of the service provider being unable to deliver. Checking this at the service provider end helps, because what happens is then service provider is also making an arrangement for taking care of this risk for his business. For example, the same example, say, of riots. So if the service provider has or offices or is spread in multiple cities, he can ensure deliverables from another location, right? So that's how he can mitigate this kind of risk. Even natural calamity, right? So if you have, I would say, delivery centers, as they are called, offshore delivery centers, ODC, if they are in two different seismic zones, seismic zones is where one zone is affected or impacted by earthquake, and the other one is in another zone which is not in the. So if you have two offices in the same seismic zone, and if there's an earthquake, both will be impacted. But if you have offices which are in two different seismic zones, that single earthquake won't impact both offices, right? So here you have the flexibility of delivering from, say, your other office, or you may want to name it as your disaster recovery center. So which is why large outsourcing deals, the customer checks for business continuity plans from the service provider as well, right? So these are basically risk in outsourcing, and you just mentioned here that there, when you are doing that risk charting, right, you can assess it and basically club them under headings for ease of, I would say, deliberation and tracking. You can club them under engagement, delivery, operations, and a composite risk, so that at each phase you are on top of this risk in terms of mitigating them, or taking care of them in terms of alternatives, or even accepting a risk, right? So this structure will help you in terms of not working aggressively on an operational risk when you are in the engagement period, right? So the categorization helps you to prioritize basically your attention as an organization to the risk. Now, let us quickly touch upon a risk management process, right? So, this is basically how you tabulate and manage a particular risk, and this process is, I would say, pretty simple. So, the process works in a cyclic manner. Like, you have the starting point is risk assessment, where you assess the risk. Now, after assessment, you basically, what you do is there is a chain of definition, monitoring, and review, right? You assess a risk, then you define a control for that risk, right? Once you define a control, you monitor it, you review that control, right? After review, you check again the status of the risk, you update the assessment, and you see whether that risk has been completely handled. So, very briefly touching upon this, the first one is the risk assessment. So, what you are doing here is you are using instruments like the classification matrix, right, to build an overview of the risk, right. You will have a view on the relevant risk drivers and what are the indicators, right. If you remember the matrix, then you have a priority given to that risk. Based on the impact, right, of that risk, you classify that risk, whether it's a high, medium, or low, right? And then once you have that risk register and in discussion with the management, you may have a action which is mitigation. It's like you, what is it that will mitigate this risk, or an acceptance. It's a risk where you can't do anything, right? It is something that needs to be accepted, right? Is there a way that this risk can be avoided or shared, right? So these are some of the attributes. Basically, the larger org, they have a RAID registers, RAID, where the first one talks, R talks of the risk, right? And you generally have those RAID log discussions, right? So this RAID stands for risk, assumptions, issues, and dependencies. So assessment basically helps you identify what kind of risk is and tabulate it. So as I mentioned in the process, once you have done the assessment, you define a control, right? So how do you define a control? You set a KPI for each risk indicator. This KPI then acts as a control because it is a measurable value. It helps you to demonstrate the effectiveness, right, in achieving the objectives. So what happens is the decision to implement a particular control, right, here is again at the onus of the senior management and in collaboration with the service provider. So in definition of the controls, the KPI helps you to define the control for each risk indicator. And what are these controls? So basically there are four types of controls. You have basic, reactive, reflective, and proactive, right? So basic is, it's like general, applies to all. Reactive and proactive is easily understood. Reactive is you apply to specific sources of risk as a reaction. Proactive is you apply to the higher priority risk, right? And it's a proactive measure, right? Reflective category 3 is applied to risk which is high priority and also includes continuous post performance monitoring and reporting. So you have controls which can be classified under these four types for defining. Once you've defined a control, as I mentioned earlier, you need to monitor that control, right? Who is accountable for monitoring that control? That becomes important. And under monitoring, it is important to measure that control, right? So you basically monitor, measure, and then report this at agreed frequency and time length. Reporting becomes critical as part of the monitoring aspect. So how the process works? Assessment, you define the control, you monitor the control, and then next is you review this control. After this publishing of the reports, you have to review this at regular intervals to assess the effectiveness, whether that control has had effect, right? And it needs to be reviewed against the agreed objective, right? So reviewing of control then helps you to check the effectiveness of how the control has worked. And what will happen post review? You again, as a cyclic step, update the risk assessment, right? You see whether this control has worked on the risk aspect that was defined, right? You may have to probably check for obsolescence also, because over a period of time, some risk or actions or control may be time bound, right? Some may have factors which are dependent on other conditions, like business conditions or if there's a new control in discussion. So this updation will essentially go back as an input to the baseline to, I would say, give clarity on the current standing or status of the risk, right? Let us look at this matrix, and which we were discussing earlier also, for the risk priority. And I've deliberately included this so that you get a view on this. So what happens is the x-axis or the bottom, this axis works on the likelihood of the risk. As you move to the left, it's seldom, and the right is frequent. So if it's more likely, the risk would move that side. If it is less likely, it would be here. So plotting of that risk is easier. You look at the likelihood and then you look at the severity. If the severity is negligible, it's towards the bottom. If it's critical, it's towards the high, right? So for example, likelihood of flood in a city like Mumbai. So you would definitely not keep it at frequent. You would keep it somewhere near the low or mid portion, like right, largely near the low to mid region, right? Severity, it can be high, right? Because a city like Mumbai functions purely on the transportation. If transportation is at a halt, the impact is huge. So it gets placed somewhere here. And based on these attributes, you have 9 different quadrants where you have scoring of low, moderate and high, right? So it works in this gradual manner. When your risk is in this lower quadrant, right, where the likelihood is also low and the impact is low, you can get into an excess state, right? Likelihood is low, severity is low, right? And you have the risk which is falling under this quadrant. If it is, I would say, moderate or increasing in likelihood as well as severity, there you may need to look at aspects of sharing that risk, right, or reducing the impact of that risk, because now you know the risk is more likely to happen. Earlier it was like the likelihood is low, so here the chances of that risk happening are high, right? So here one needs to then work on at least I would say mitigating that particular risk in terms of seeing whether it can be shared with a vendor or it can be reduced by certain actions. The extreme corner where the likelihood is frequent, right, and the severity is also high, it's critical. So that point is where you will need to look at avoiding that risk, right? You either avoid it 100% or you transfer that risk to another, I would say, service provider or another stakeholder. So this is how the risk priority matrix works. Again, you plot the risk based on likelihood and severity, see which quadrant it falls, and then you take actions on it. Again, as I said, this is a reference structure available to you, and one should always link it with inputs or factors which are there on this, right? Let us look at guidelines to secure outsourcing. We've seen most of the challenges and risk in outsourcing. We've covered them. Let us quickly look at some guidelines that can be used. There are 6 guidelines that can be used for secure outsourcing. Now that we've gone through most of the challenges and risks. So the first one is selecting the right outsourcing vendor. Now again, if you remember the first challenge, right, was in terms of doing the right assessment and getting the right partner, right? So guideline would be, right, something which will help you cover that challenge and mitigate that risk. So selecting the right outsourcing vendor, this is a key guideline, because vendor engagement is key to success here, right? One should follow the aspects of due diligence, checks and balances, feedbacks, right? Vendor assessment, customer feedback, reference check, right? The capability assessment of the service provider should be done, and the right outsourcing partner should be selected. So the first guideline talks of selecting the right outsourcing vendor or service provider. The next guideline is important to clarify the intellectual property and privacy policies. So as I mentioned, this being a legal aspect, you are going to be contractually engaged with the vendor. So it is important to cover the intellectual property issue and clarify and document it in the contract prehand, right? You discuss it out, clarify it in the contract, you agree upfront on the ownership of the IP being created by virtue of the partnership. If you remember the example of software development, right, where ownership of the source code, right, that was the example that I had given. So it's important to clarify prehand and agree, right? It's either you negotiate on price and agree that service provider or vendor owns it, or you don't budge in and get ownership on that particular I would say source code. So clarifying intellectual property becomes important. That's guideline number two. Guideline number three is linked to data protection, right? So a lot of data is in play, essentially by virtue of your sharing the entire I would say knowledge transferred to the vendor and data, so that that is required for the service provider to function and run the process smoothly, right? So data protection methods are important in the organization, and one needs to check. These can I would be held set as baselines, right? And data leakage is critical, right? How data incident, data leakage incident will be handled, that's important to know. So you should check in terms of the data aspects, trying to find out how the data, because it's critical, it's business data, is being handled and stored. Even data storage is important, right? Many organizations run into non-compliance because of improper data storage guidelines from the government, right? So on the data front, you have technical aspects as well, right? You have proper database monitoring gateways and firewalls which restrict ease of access of the data, right? And here one can also check on the access part. You should not give access to more than required data, right, just to safeguard. So that's guideline number three. Moving to guideline number four, this is again important, links to data as well, is the POLP principle, which is principle of least privilege. And it is strongly recommended that this principle is used in the engagement with the service provider, because this can help misuse. Yeah, right. So what happens under this? The access required is provided only need-based and with a certain privilege only, right? For example, to make you understand, you give an access to a system and you have multiple privilege levels, right? You don't give a admin privilege where the data can be copied or damaged also. So need, if the need is only for viewing that data, one can give a read level privilege. If there is a need to write data, then write access is available. Admin access may also be given if the entire database is being handled. But use this, one should use this principle to I would say tightly govern the data control aspects. Coming to the next guideline, which is security policies. So it is important to check for the security policies, right? And because these will help cover aspects of data classification and access, right? It will help distinguish, right, between the personal identifiable information and SPII, specific PII, right? PII, just for information, it's like data which links to identity of the individual. in terms of, say, I as an individual, you have access to my date of birth, address, credit card information, information which is linked to the personal aspects. As I mentioned earlier also, if you remember, countries in the Europe Union, they have a strict adherence to GDPR, right, where there is a lot of, I would say, strict compliance in terms of sharing any PII as well, right. So these security policies help serve as baseline to the service providers, right. And as I mentioned earlier, one should check for what kind of policies are already available with the service providers. It's a two-way handshake. If your organization has strong policies on access management, password management, those can be enforced for the service provider also during the contract discussions, right? These can be contractually covered and demanded as well. So security policies becomes another critical area. And the last of the guideline there is in terms of security audits. Now this is more from a third party view or assessment, I would say. If the service provider is serving multiple customers, which means he is connected to different customers, right? Data is accessible over the web, right? So whether the service provider or a vendor carries out any security audits, right? Does he have any reports of these audits? Is he in a position to submit these reports, right? Because these audits help indicate what kind of loopholes are there, security loopholes in the setup. So if you have heard of VAPT, right, that's vulnerability assessment and penetration testing. Now that this is kind of test that is done to check for security loopholes. Under penetration testing, there are deliberate attempts made to enter into the network, right? So that's an example that I've given you. So one should check, right, for the security audits undertaken by the service provider, whether there is a frequency. And as I mentioned, before getting into the contract, one can agree, right, that you would carry out an audit. That can be a cost impact as well, and that can be pre-agreed, right, whether both share the cost or the service provider does it by himself. But these serve as good reference to the current security standing of the service provider setup. So that's guideline number 6. And quickly, just to summarize, right, we ran through the challenges, risk management process, right, and even some guidelines. So you would agree that with the pressure of volume of work, deadlines, the cultures, communication language, other barriers, outsourcing can be challenging and may have multiple challenges and risks. But these can be handled, right? And to sustain positive transitions, it is a dual relationship. Both the organization should build trust and confidence in the engagement, right, and take it forward. Thank you.